Welcome to the Educause podcast. This podcast features a session from the Educause 2012 annual conference. The session is entitled Discovery in a Digital World, and our speaker is Edward Ayers, president of the University of Richmond.
Great to see all those of you who did not roll out your luggage through the lobby this morning. So it's great that your dedication to knowledge and learning and to Educause. Now, let me just admit that I'm in something of an awkward position up here. I've been an advocate for new technologies for teaching and research since the 1970s, when I improbably developed an affection for punch cards and batch jobs. Then I fell in love with hypertext in the 1980s and a Next machine in the early 90s. And I was doing SGML when HTML suddenly appeared. And so I've been on the web since 1993 with a series of projects. And I've even written for Educause Review. And yet, I stand before you with some trepidation. And not merely because of your formidable numbers and expertise. It's because I stand before you as a humanist. Now, we know that the critics and skeptics of technology-mediated learning often come from my part of the academic world. Historians and literary scholars and art historians and others of our kind often defend quite passionately the necessity of personal engagement, the value of the institutions and traditions we've inherited, the hard-won gains of centuries that people now casually look to disrupt. And even those of us receptive to innovation, and many of us are, cannot help but observe that our subjects and methods do not seem very prominent in the discussion of MOOCs. I see no humanities courses at Udacity or edX. At Coursera, about 15 of the 200 classes fit into the humanities as we normally define them, though they've added classes like conversation that works into that category so that it bumps it up to 31 courses. The TED Talks that promote those initiatives say little about the humanities. But despite this dissonance and despite this silence, we cannot afford to talk past each other. The humanities and new forms of learning need each other. In fact, the humanities may be the most useful things that we can teach in digital environments and elsewhere. While proponents of MOOCs talk of their potential for transforming the world, gulfs of trust and empathy and cooperation among individuals and groups remain essential obstacles that will never be resolved by STEM disciplines alone. The very complications the humanities present, I would argue, are part of our value to the emerging conversation. Until we develop new strategies to deal with the rich and chaotic evidence of the humanities and online environments, we will simply teach what is easiest to teach in those environments: procedural, processual topics that can be broken into pieces and tested in chunks. The humanities, by contrast, focus on evidence not unlike the evidence that life itself presents us every day: ambiguous, contradictory, incomplete, ironic, limitless, and boundless. If the new machinery of teaching cannot find ways to teach such matters, then that machinery will work within crippling constraints, no matter how useful the other things it teaches us are. People around the world need STEM knowledge, but they need, no less than the students who fill the universities that are producing MOOCs, ways to understand the world, ways that permit them to be leaders and citizens wherever they live. But I want to talk to my fellow humanist friends, too, and tell them that we need the capacities of these new ways of learning. The problem is not that we're using technology. It's that we're using too few of its capacities. Using a worldwide network of instantaneous exchange of information to ship around videos or PDFs or even interactive quizzes does not take advantage of its abilities to show us things in new ways, to see things we could not see otherwise. Most fundamentally, the excited conversations about MOOCs don't mention, as far as I can tell, the generation of new intellectual capital, the creation of knowledge, the power of discovery in a digital age. Instead, those conversations promote teaching as the conveyance of what is already known. Now, as exciting and worthwhile as it is to reach vast global audiences with important courses people want and need, that enterprise cannot run on borrowed intellectual capital forever. More than that, the rhetoric of efficiency, of speed, and of massive audiences can lead us to neglect the possibility for defining a place for knowledge creation at the very birth of these remarkable new capacities. And we all know that higher education takes its great energy, its defining purpose, from a charged circuit between teaching and research, a circuit between disseminating knowledge and making knowledge. Scholars and students learn and teach at the same time. Discovery beats at the very heart of what we're all about. Now, we also know, unfortunately, that teaching and research often seem and are often experienced and often are in polar opposites. Despite our best efforts, institutional self-interest and professional advancement and scholarly innovation and devotion to teaching often pull against each other. I've watched for the last 20 years of the digital humanities as new ideas and initiatives are starved and stunted because they do not fit into easily established networks of creation and evaluation and dissemination. The longing to use these remarkable new tools to create new ways of understanding the human experience are there, but we seem to be putting obstacles in our own path. But perhaps now, precisely because of the challenges presented by MOOCs and other new technologies, these competing forces can be brought into better alignment through what we call digital scholarship. Digital scholarship is scholarly work expressly designed to make the most of the possibilities of the electronic medium and of the online world. Now, this seems like an anachronistic combination of words, digital scholarship. Scholarship has been around as a concept since the 16th century, when it referred to those who knew how to read Latin and Greek. But it has been open source since its inception for centuries. Scholarship collaborates with people who may have died long ago and with scholars yet to be born. Nobody owns its ideas or methods. They are given freely, shared freely, adopted freely. Humanists believe that that tradition of scholarship, sustaining that scholarly conversation, is why we exist. We are, in many ways, the collective memory of humans. If we do not work continuously to renew and reframe our understanding of the human record, it will fade and blur. If we do not work to understand people in different times and cultures and religions and situations from ourselves, we will lose our knowledge of them. And it is scholarship, vital and ongoing, that stands between us and that forgetfulness that always threatens. Scholarship, it's important to understand, is more than content that content providers provide. It is more than fungible and pliable teaching materials to be piped into remote locations. It is the very structure and momentum and legacy of any particular content. Without the thread of the conversation to give it shape and purpose, scholarly content is inert. So we need digital scholarship, not just humanities content, if we are going to use the new technologies to teach people effectively about the vast human record. We need digital spaces built around significant questions important for knowledge creation and excellent for teaching in many contexts. They can be good for MOOCs, but they can also be good for people sitting and learning together in face-to-face communities and inquiry. They can sustain original discovery by thousands of students, each of whom will see a unique pattern in a complex evidence, a work of scholarship frames, but it could also speak to a single scholar alone. They can build bridges of understanding where we seldom have them now, speaking to novices and to experts, to K-12 and to those who continue learning deep into their lives. It can repay an hour of study, but it can repay many hours of study. Now, as a historian, for example, I dream about what it would be like if we could visualize complex social processes unfolding over time. If we had an fMRI of social change. In our minds, historians do this all the time. As we assimilate more and more information, we can, in our imaginations, scan across large spaces and long stretches of time. We can see patterns branching and converging, taking off into unexpected directions and dimensions. We can zoom into individuals and zoom out to entire continents. We can picture what I've called deep contingency, fundamental shifts in social structures and self-understanding triggered by some sudden change in communal life, shifts that spiral and spin throughout entire social orders, that reconfigure individual lives as well as entire government. To me, that's what history looks like. It's not a shelf of books embalming received knowledge. It is not a list of names and dates. It is not things that can be conveyed in multiple choice exams, but rather it is that vision. So the obvious question is, wouldn't it be great if we could let non-experts see those maps in our heads? And wouldn't it be great, in fact, if we could actually make better maps than our limited internal bandwidth and processing capacity allows in our head? We can't tell two stories at the same time, for example, in our head. We have limits on our imaginations. Fortunately, we're living in a time when geographic history is suddenly the rage. History, like every other humanistic discipline, has taken what we call the spatial turn. The reasons for this seem pretty clear. Maps fill our zeitgeist. Electronic maps are everywhere, from phones and dashboards to television screens and online newspapers. We are thrown into confusion when the latest iPhone has a subpar mapping feature. But maps let us see all kinds of natural human phenomena at all scales and virtually limitless ways. So they would seem to be especially useful for historians who need to see complex phenomena played out over space as well as time. So it seems obvious that mapping would be central to history. And yet there has not been a comprehensive historical atlas of the United States based on original research since 1932. That atlas of the historical geography of the United States was a product of the turn of the last century, 1902, when they're trying to put in place the fundamental machinery of a new profession. And even today, latest textbooks still reproduce maps from that atlas, 20 years in the making, published in 1932. My colleagues at the Digital Scholarship Lab at the University of Richmond, Rob Nelson, Scott Nesbitt, and Nate Ayers, have received permission from the Carnegie Institution for Science to recreate that atlas in digital form. And they will soon be sharing that volume in an enhanced and amplified version that connects to the georectified maps underneath, that lets them live in our current digital environment. They'll eventually publish more than 500 interactive maps covering nearly every theme of American history and geography. But one thing we love about that book is this quote. This is 1932. "The ideal historical atlas might well be a collection of motion picture maps. If these could be displayed on the pages of a book without the paraphernalia of projector, reel, and screen." In 1932, they're imagining tablets. They're imagining, what if these inert maps that we have drawn with these age-old techniques could live? What if they could move? Because that is what history is. Now, four generations later, we finally have the technology that they dreamed of to create this so-called ideal historical atlas. So we're collaborating with people that have been gone for several generations, trying to keep their scholarly dream alive. So we've created a series of experiments toward a new digital atlas of American history. And in a time when specific details that students might want about any particular topic in American history are available instantly and for free and often true, when the rationale for textbooks is fading, the need for synthesis and coherence and context remains. In fact, the very profusion of disconnected detail in the digital world makes the need for connected understanding all the more essential. The atlas ties things together across decades and across the entire continent and beyond, revealing continuity and change and consistency and variability in ways that are otherwise invisible. In our age of disaggregation, some way to synthesize seems to be a great need. So here's a quick movie that gives you a sense of some of our ongoing projects toward that end. You'll notice that we use several different modalities, ranging from photorealistic simulation to the machinery of social science and science. What these experiments have in common is that they focus on the interaction of time and space, the defining traits of historical understanding. So we begin by zooming in to the coast of Virginia and flowing up the James River. This is a recreation of what the landscape would have looked like at the time of European discovery. This is a map from created in the 1930s, been reprocessed about the different neighborhoods of Richmond. This is topic modeling, reading the New York Times and the Richmond newspaper throughout the entire era of the Civil War to find patterns that would otherwise be invisible. This shows the history of immigration in the United States with the shafts shooting up in times of special immigration. And what you'll see here in our own time, that we're living in a time where immigration is especially strong. These are maps of marriages between enslaved people, taken at the moment of 1865 when slavery comes to an end. Each of those lines reflected where a husband and a wife live and show the dynamic nature of slavery. This is a project we made because we're in the sesquicentennial of the Civil War and Emancipation. And this reads 3,000 pages of all the debates of the Virginia Secession Convention and then finds the geographic and temporal and voting patterns within them and allows people to actually answer this old question, what caused the Civil War? This is a simulation of John Marshall's home in Richmond, which is now going back and imagining what it was like to live in urban slavery. And these were just marks on a map that we've recreated. And this is our project that has special relevance for today, Voting America, that shows every election from many different perspectives, from 1840 up to, I wouldn't say the present, but we don't have the 2012 election returns in here. But what you can see, the things that we've all been fixating on, talking about over the last months, the patterns have been there playing out in these deep patterns for decades, for generations. And for students to be able to look at that and see patterns that they think are something we've discovered in our own time is something unusual. Now, we've recently debuted our most fully realized effort toward the kind of deep mapping and that project, built with a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, is Visualizing Emancipation. And it addresses a central debate. I want to pause this and a central debate in 19th century U.S. history. How did 4 million enslaved Americans become free? When and how and at what cost? To what extent was the Union Army an ally? You don't know it yet, but you're going to be thinking about this because you're probably going to go see the new Steven Spielberg film, Lincoln, which is debuting in major cities. Those of you returning home to New York, you can see it this weekend. I missed it last night, a special preview, because I was here at EDUCAUSE, because I'm committed to our common purpose of pandering. I did not know that would do that. But they filmed it in Richmond, and the story is basically Abraham Lincoln wrestling with the end of the war and the end of slavery. It's interesting. Where's our great movie about the end of slavery? We have the Gone with the Wind, imagining from the viewpoint of Scarlett, who has to make a dress from the curtains. But where's the story of the people who had to become free with nothing but the shirts on their backs? How would we have our students imagine the most important thing that's ever happened in this country, the end of perpetual bondage for 4 million people? How might we understand that in ways that we cannot today? So this is a live historiographic debate. Scholars on different sides of all these kinds of issues. Others say emancipation was built into the very purpose of the war. It was only a matter of time until this great nation could no longer tolerate slavery, even though we tolerated it for 250 years by this time. Other people say it emerged as a military necessity. Others that the enslaved people freed themselves. Others that it was the leadership of Abraham Lincoln. Some argue that the soldiers in the United States Army embraced their role as liberators, and others say, no, they ended the war much as they began it, largely unconcerned with and even antagonistic to black Southerners. So this isn't the easiest subject to tackle. It's not that we have figured out, and now we're going to tell people. We want to bring people in as we are trying to figure it out. We want them to help us understand what this might be like. Now, this is a tough subject. It doesn't happen like elections in the full historical light. It did not come on a few days and on a fixed geographic stage like a battle. Instead, it came around the edges of the story of the Civil War. It started before the war actually began and ended long after the war had come to a close. It happened on dark roads and in obliquely worded government documents. It started, and then it stopped. It raced ahead, and then it retracted. Military events helped it, and then hindered it. White Northerners supported it, and then resisted it. How in the world would we understand such a thing unfolding across an expanse the size of continental Europe? How might we glimpse the patterns, the complexities within all of that? So let's look at a quick demonstration. So this is a map that shows the blue dots are where the United States Army might be at any particular time. The red dots are where interactions of enslaved people with the United States Army. We just had January 1st, 1863 pass. We see there's some areas where it does not affect. Read this for a minute. This is a story of an enslaved woman interacting with the United States Army. And what you see there are ravish, rape. United States Army, the people risk their lives to become free, and when they get there, they discover that there are these, that emancipation does not look like what they had imagined that it would be. So we let the story play out over the course of the rest of the war, because now we search for women to see what was females' experience in this. And you can see that the red dots all across the vast expanse of the South is that there are episodes like this, where young women, older women, risking everything in their lives to become free. What are their stories? And we have 3,500 stories of those individuals. That's what it looks like by the end of the story. That those are all the places that we have found evidence of African Americans interacting with the Union Army. So as you can see, we can show you all the different types of emancipation, all the different sources. This is based on a 128-volume collection called The Official Record of the War of the Rebellion, put together back in the 1890s. But we've been able to go back and, with help from Greg Crane from Tufts University, to geocode that, to be able to turn what had been a relatively inert body of volumes into a dynamic map. And then we've gone through and reading newspapers and diaries and found these episodes of enslaved people risking everything in their lives to become free. So you can see that the pattern doesn't look like the patterns in our textbook where you have all one color and then another. And you can see that even in Louisiana, which had been set aside from the Emancipation Proclamation because it was in Union hands. But you can start with that one story, of that one heartbreaking account of the soldiers sort of run amok. And it can spin out into a unique understanding. Because you can start with any of these dots and see the story that emerges along the way. Now, this has several aspects of things that I think we might want to think about. It bears several attributes of digital scholarship. First, is a part of a significant scholarly debate. It actually tells us things that we could not see otherwise. My co-PI on this project, Scott Nesbitt, and I have published an article in a peer-reviewed journal that uses some of our work to suggest that we need to reframe the whole question about the shape of emancipation. So digital scholarship is going to have to contribute to establish forms of scholarly communication if it is going to gain traction in the academy. Second, as you can see, this project experiments with digital representation. Its form grew from the questions that we were asking. We had to come in and invent what these kinds of the machinery might look like. So we're going to have to do this for each of the projects that we want to address. Third, all this data can be shared with other projects and other people. People are able to add events and to download all our data. In the tradition of scholarship, we want to make sure that everybody can benefit from the things that we are doing. And fourth, much of the research for this project was done by undergraduate students at the University of Richmond, some from humanities backgrounds and some from computer science and geography. Undergraduate research in the humanities has been a tough nut to crack. We're jealous of our colleagues in the sciences who seem to have an opportunity to bring their students in as colleagues. But we think that digital scholarship actually allows humanists to bring in our undergraduates as well, to give them appropriate levels of sophistication and difficulty and responsibility. The current model of MOOCs, ironically, is very top-down. It is coming from most prestigious universities and then distributed among others. Wouldn't it be better if people at every stage, at every level, had a sense that they could contribute to the knowledge that was being shared? Even undergraduate students of liberal arts colleges can contribute, so can lots of other people as well. We call this generative scholarship. Scholarship that generates new questions, new evidence, new conclusions, and new audiences as it is used. It is not done and then handed to somebody to be quizzed upon and tested, but rather it is formed and handed to people. Help us figure this out. Help us make it better. Help us make it richer. Share with your colleagues ways that you're understanding of what we might be able to do with this. Now, this generative scholarship embodies several characteristics that Diane Obliger has recently identified in her book Game Changers as particularly valuable components of IT augmented learning. It reflects an apprenticeship model in which learners gain skill and accelerate their development by interacting with others who are more expert. So we had an idea of where you would find this evidence. We give you an idea of what emancipation types might be. But that's the master part of it. The apprenticeship part, you figure it out now. We've given you the tools. You see all the same evidence we do. You have insight. You help us figure it out. Second, it embodies hard fun, in which emotional engagement, surprise, or puzzlement, or awe increases learner effort and attention. I know those words weren't up there for very long, but when you read them, and you will see the power that leaps off a screen, that left off a page from something 150 years ago about the most profound change in our history. It is engaging, both because of the way the machinery works, but also because of the content. It reflects situations in the real world in which simulations and virtual environments mimic settings in which decisions are made. So this mimics the research of a historian in which we are presented with all this evidence we have to make sense of. But it also mimics the real world. What would you do found with nothing but a shirt upon your back and enemies all around? Would you take the risk of trying to make it to Union lines, not knowing what those soldiers might mean for you? It taps into the power of feed forward, using techniques to draw learners into new experiences and connecting them with how to learn more. You can't look at this without wondering, well, what was military history like? You can't look at this without thinking, well, this seems so saturated with politics. How did that work? And you certainly cannot use this without wanting to know more about the African Americans who found themselves in these positions. And finally, this example of generative scholarship uses structured autonomy, in which students are provided with prompts and guides and hints that can help learners pass obstacles. These features are built into the very structure of this evidence of generative scholarship itself. Now, one thing you can see just in the brief time that you saw that is that any simple thesis about the causes and consequences of emancipation are inadequate. Sweeping statements about who freed the slaves are misleading and even counterproductive in their false simplicity. The individual cases here confound facile generalization, which is the very thing that we often teach in our history classes. Forget about the complexity. What's the bottom line? What's the facile generalization you want to make? And this says, don't think that way. Human lives are as complex as anything in nature, and you should not expect otherwise. And in all honesty, this is the sort of discovery that we are likely to make in complex digital scholarship. It will not produce a clean correlation or a straight line, but rather interesting and productive clusters of insights that redefine problems in more clearly articulated but still complicated ways. Because humans are complex, the art, music, literature, and history they create is complex. We don't need or want to flatten that complexity, but rather to see that complexity more clearly in patterns we might not be able to see otherwise. I'll admit that I was inspired to do this by being Dean of Arts and Sciences and being president and reading tenure files and seeing that my friends in the sciences or engineering, medicine, often began their work with an image and then explicated that. Then I noticed that my friends in the humanities seldom availed ourselves of visualization. But one of the great gifts of the new technologies we have now is they allow us to see things that otherwise would have been invisible. We would not have been able to see the pattern in the 3,000 pages of the secession debates. We would not have been able to see the patterns in 128 volumes of the official records of the War of the Rebellion until very recently. We suddenly have billions of words in the newspapers of all the past before us. How can we not be curious about what lies within them? Not unlike astronomers who are able to peer back into time with new technologies, digital humanists are finding ourselves at that same exciting moment if we can take advantage of it. Online environments, like other defining popular media types of our time, like extended television dramas, reflect our fascination with what one recent book calls vast narratives. Vast narratives. Vastness conveys a sense of layered, complex, and open-ended worlds. And generative scholarship can also evoke vastness, connection where we might not expect it, truth inherent in forms that don't impose artificial boundaries. Tables and graphs and even maps are not our subjects, but rather the scaffolding for humanistic insights. The subject of the digital humanities will remain the human experience. As a result, we will need to think about technique and form and the words we use to convey what we see. How do you write about those patterns that we glimpsed? How do you turn a photorealistic simulation into an analysis? So generative scholarship is not going to necessarily displace other forms of scholarship, but it can help enliven them and renew them and broaden them. So, as you can see, I think it's important that we build tools that take advantage of the medium in which they are conveyed, that we exploit the capacities of the networks and the processing that present materials to large and diverse audiences, that lend themselves to expert discovery, that can be used repeatedly without exhaustion. You're never going to beat visualizing emancipation. You're not going to figure out all that it has to teach you. That do things that could not be done otherwise. That make the form as well as the content of our work the object of intention and experimentation. That's why we call it generative scholarship. And it is based on the knowledge that the key to effective education, whatever the discipline, whatever the size, and whatever the medium, is engagement. That engagement can be as simple as a conversation and as complex as virtual reality. It can happen in person and it can be online. We do not want to let the prospect of exciting new developments Blind as to what we have now. Institutions where we are engaging in human contact and teaching and learning. We do not have to have a displacement, a disruptive model. We can think about a model in which we harvest all that we have learned over so many generations of hard work, of augmenting ways to teach, not displacing them. So I say to my fellow humanists, skeptical of MOOCs and the like, that the problem is not that we're using technology. It's that we're using too few of its capacities. We need to design scholarship native to the digital medium, to do things that exploit its ability to see patterns otherwise invisible, to make users partners in the creation of new knowledge, of discovery. And historians need to do so with a particular sense of urgency. The teaching of history has languished as we have focused so much on reading and mathematics as a result of No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top. A report from the Department of Education finds that our nation's history is the subject our nation's children understand least well. We need to make tools that can be widely and freely shared with the teachers who are doing their best to teach our young people about the fundamentals of our nation's and other nations' history. I'm not sure there's anything more important for us to be teaching than ways for young people to help find their place in space and in time, to help make sense of some of the vast confusion that confronts us all. Thank you very much. Let's have some generating questions and answers here. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. I know you cannot possibly have believed all of that, so please step to the microphones and offer warm and friendly and yet challenging questions. Who wants to go first? People are making their way to the microphone, just in case you're wondering. Yes.
You mentioned that you and your co-PI published an article in a peer-reviewed journal.
Yes.
And earlier this fall, the American Historical Association voted down a proposal to... Goodness, my iPod is playing. Sorry. I bumped something. The AHA voted down a proposal to take their journals open access. How can we convince historians that the scholarship that they do that interprets the kind of data that you're talking about should be as open as the data itself?
Yeah, what a great question. Do we have any others? That was really hard. I don't want to do that. You know, I think, you know, the American Historical Review actually published a digital article that Will Thomas and I wrote back in 2003 as an experiment to see, do we not nearly only need to make the traditional form of scholarship open access, but do we need to have journal articles in which the evidence itself is open and in which the connections to the libraries and archives in which our evidence comes are open? So I'm sympathetic to your question about us wanting to share things as broadly as possible, but I think we also actually need to rethink the forms of scholarship. And I say this to my science friends as well. The forms of our scholarship have not changed. We still write journal articles with abstracts at the beginning. Every discipline has a different form. But think about what if our journal articles actually connected to the evidentiary base underneath. Now think about history right now. So I think in whatever way that we can make this material shared as broadly as possible, that we should. Yes.
Thank you. Great talk.
Thank you.
Could you offer some tips to... from your perspective as president, to help our campuses mobilize around high-priority digital initiatives like the ones you're doing at Richmond?
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think that the key to all of this is faculty. Faculty have to be able to see within these possibilities opportunities that are not career-killing. You know, having done this for 20 years, and I tell the story, I gave a talk at the Library of Congress over a decade ago, and a young woman stood up and said, "I liked your talk, but it makes me want to cry." I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Because there's so many of us who would love to do this stuff, and they won't let us. They being advisors, hiring committees." And so presidents and provosts and deans love this stuff because it's something for us to talk about and put in alumni magazine and show innovation. But people closer to it, do we really want to squander one of our lines in our department on somebody who might be launching off on this weird stuff rather than writing a monograph to which we know there's a return, right? And so that's why I think that you can help people by finding those mavericks, those people who are either brave enough or wayward enough to think that how can we not take advantage of the major social change of our time to reinvent what I'm devoting my life to, right? Now, that's lonely. If you're by yourself and you're trying to think about how would I do this, you cannot do it. But if you had a CIO or a dean or a provost or a president even who said, you know, we don't know what this should look like because it's faculty who know what scholarship should look like, but we would like to enable it. Now, ironically, one problem is that right now this has been equated so much with teaching that it is devalued for promotion and tenure. So that's the reason I'm calling it the Digital Scholarship Lab. The reason I'm talking about generative scholarship is that we need to find ways that scholars can advance their field, which is why they got into this in the first place, through these means. So I think that our friends in teaching technology are great and often know more about this than anybody else. But we need to engage scholars where they live if we're going to change all this. I think the universities are ready. But we need to build a bridge to the people who would actually do the work, who have the imagination. You'll notice these are weird projects. These are not something that a corporation would think up, right? It's like because, well, what kind of market is there going to be for this particular thing? Instead, it grows out of a scholarly passion, which is by its very nature is irrational, right? But that's okay. That's what drives. It's the curiosity. It's this discovery in my title. What we need to do is be allies to the people who have that irrational longing to discover as a part of their DNA. Yes. Oh, hi. Number three. Yes, right there.
So most of the work that you showed relied heavily on visualization.
Yes.
And to sort of riff on your comment about we're not using enough technology, what does that data feel like? What does it smell like? You know, what does it sound like?
Yep.
Are you aware of other work going on to explore other modalities of representation and combine those things and so forth?
Yeah, that's another great question that I would say the history of senses is something that scholars are working on very hard. I think that you're more likely to find this in literary study. So what I showed is a history, and it even has a little bit of a social scientific edge to it, rather than what we might think of as a more humanistic scale. I think that with the net, ironically, back in the days of CD-ROMs, we in some ways had more multimedia than we do today. Back in the days, it would seem like sound could be integrated into our presentations better than they can today. Now, recently, with I figure people can download entire brand new movies illegally. We should be able to convey all the senses that you're talking about in that regard. So far, visualization does seem to be the shortest route between data and some new insight. What does it feel like? You have to worry that would people stop and never get that feeling of decaying paper underneath their fingernails, that smell of the archives. What I would like to think is that these things will be incentives to go see where this knowledge originally comes from. I wanted to drive people to special collections to turn the pages of these books that are 150 years old. I want them to actually go find the old newspapers and see what it does feel and smell like. That's a great question. We wouldn't want to lose that sensory world as we create this one of bits. Great question. Is there one more question? Someone is coming to microphone number 4. Yes.
Hello. In starting any project, there are always preconceived ideas of how it's going to end or what information is going to be created or maybe even hints at what questions, new questions, will be created. What turned out to be the surprises?
Yeah, I did this project back in the 90s called The Valley of the Shadow that took 14 years to build. And then I wrote a book about it that has two paragraphs at the beginning. It says, oh, by the way, this is built on a digital archive. Forget that. Now it's a book, right? And so I think one of the things that's so exciting right now, and scary as can be, I don't know how to write a book out of visualizing emancipation. I don't know what a journal article should look like from all that. And I think that's one reason that people don't do it, is like, what's the bridge to that? Scott Nesbitt, who's behind much of what you see here, is writing a monograph using this. I think what we've discovered is, and I gave a hint to this, that the maps and the graphs and the charts are the scaffolding, the beginning of the insight that would point to this experience of these women with the Union Army in New Iberia, Louisiana, in April 1863. We see it now because of the map, but the map needs to fall away as we tell a story that uses techniques of engagement we already know, called narrative and storytelling and evocation. So that is what's so exciting to me about this. We have a rare opportunity to harvest these new techniques to do what we've already loved to do better. We don't have to throw away what it means to be a good teacher or what it means to be a good scholar. What we can do is to say, wow, how fortunate are we to live at a time when we have the entire record of the human experience available to us in a way that humans have never seen it before. And with those words, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today. Thank you.